In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about income inequality here in the United States. There are plenty of numbers we can offer you, and we probably will in this hour of the show. But the bottom line is that the gap between the very wealthy and the rest of the nation has continued over the last couple of decades to widen. And the question that we're talking about is, why is it that inequality has grown so much? And how does that, as a nation, how does it hold us back? We have two guests with us in this part of Focus 580, and they are Betsy Leander Wright and Jim Lardner. Betsy Leander Wright is communications director with an organization called United for a Fair Economy. James Lardner, he is a nonprofit administrator, political activist, who is the founder of a website called inequality.org. Both of them interested in the same sort of issue. James Lardner has written articles that have appeared in a number of places, including U.S. News and World Report, The New Yorker, New Yorker Review of Books, and other publications. Betsy Leander Wright, in her efforts as communications director of United for a Fair Economy, tries to link journalists with resources in order to raise the profile of economic inequality, that issue at least in the mass media. Before becoming involved with United for a Fair Economy, she directed two organizations. One was the Massachusetts Human Services Coalition and the Anti-Displacement Project. She's also worked as a program coordinator at Women for Economic Justice, and they are both joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, of course, questions from listeners are welcome. We just ask people to try and be brief, just so that we can get in as many people as we can and keep the program moving. But of course, listeners are welcome to call 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. Well, Betsy Leander Wright, hello.
Nice to be with you.
Thanks for talking with us today. And James Lardner.
Hi.
Thanks for joining us as well.
Thank you.
To begin, I guess we probably should give some numbers, and I don't want to snow people down into a whole lot of numbers just to begin with, but to give them something to grab onto, something concrete, can you give us a few numbers that show the income inequality that exists now? And maybe we could talk a little bit about what the trend has been over the last, you know, roughly speaking, 40 years.
Do you want me to try that?
Yeah, why don't you then?
Why don't you tackle income and I'll tackle wealth, too.
Okay.
Well, in the year 2000, the top 1% of the population took home more after-tax income than the bottom 40%. That's 2.8 million people out-earning 110 million people. The general picture is that the people at the top of the income pyramid have been doing very well for the last 25, 30 years, and everyone else in the population, on average, kind of keeping pace barely or falling a little behind or getting a little ahead.
Okay. And now we can talk about this in two different ways here. When you talk about income, you're talking about what people take home from their work or however they generate income. But there is also a different way of looking at prosperity, and that is wealth. That is who is not just what your take-home pay is, but other indicators of your financial well-being.
Yeah, I would define wealth, we're talking about net worth, as what you own minus what you owe. So it's your assets minus your debts. And the wealth gap is even greater than the income gap, and it's been steadily growing despite the decline in the wealth of the very rich with the stock market crash in 2001. Right now, or the most recent numbers we have, the top 1%, the richest 1% by wealth, have a third of all the privately held wealth in the United States, and the top 5% have almost 60%. About 1 in 5 Americans have negative net worth, meaning more debts than assets. And if you take the entire bottom 40%, it's only 0.3%. So historically, these are very, very high numbers in terms of the concentration of wealth. And if you look at even within the top 1%, the really rapid growth has been among a small portion of that, the top one-tenth of 1%, the super rich. That's where the the wealth that was created in the 90s went mostly there and not to the majority of Americans. Mm.
So you touched on something that I just wanted to be clear about when you're talking about wealth, which has not only to do with what you have, but do you have a house and how much it's worth and things like that, but it also does have to do with debt. It primarily is the big difference here in wealth, not just the fact that people in the bottom maybe don't own homes or don't own big homes and cars and other things like that. It mostly is that really about debt and the fact that the people who are on the lower end tend to owe more, particularly as a percentage of how much that they have, than the people on the top?
Yes, the reason that the bottom two-fifths of people by assets, their net worth fell by 46% from 1983 to 2001. And the reason for that was taking on more debt. Credit card debt zoomed, home equity loans zoomed. People just went, you know, students started taking student loans instead of getting scholarships that were grants. Debt just surged, and personal bankruptcy grew along with it. So this is the explanation for those drastically falling numbers.
When people hear these kinds of figures, I would imagine that some people would say something like, well, you know, there has always been income inequality. Throughout human history, there has always been income inequality. There have been rich people and poor people and people who are sort of in between. And they would say, is what we see now really so much different than the kind of historical inequality that we have always seen?
We are by far the most unequal of the developed nations in income and wealth, according to most of the experts who studied this data. And you have to, I guess you have to look at particular zones of life, like healthcare, for example, where you have this tremendous increase in the number of people without insurance. And at the other end of the spectrum, you have this fantastic investment of resources in things like, you know, hair transplants and other aspects of healthcare that are chic because a small number of people can want them and will pay fantastic sums of money for them. If you look at healthcare, you also look at higher education, and I guess if you finally look at our democracy, where the campaign contribution has kind of replaced the vote as the essential transaction, I think there you see great grounds for alarm. And also, America's world reputation and the way it's known to Americans themselves has always depended heavily on this idea that we're the country who your parents were, where you start out, means the least in terms of where you might go. And I think that has been true throughout a lot of American history. There's a lot of reason to doubt that it is true today. The sheer accumulation of wealth means, kind of common sense suggests, that the same people typically are earning the most year after year after year. And there's other evidence to support the view that mobility has declined. If your parents were in the bottom quintile in terms of income, your chances of reaching the top quintile, that's the top fifth, are about 42.3%. I'm stating it wrong. Your chances of reaching the top are about 6.3%. Whereas if your parents were in the top, your chances of ending up there are about 42.3%. In other words, we are just not anymore the land of world-beating opportunity that we would like to think we are.
So just to make sure I understand that, you're saying that socioeconomic class matters so much that it is most likely that where you begin, that's where you're going to end up. Is it really true that in the past there has been more economic mobility? I guess I would have thought that to a large extent that would always have been true, that where you started, not very many people can manage to move up very much from the point where they started.
Well, the recent estimates of intergenerational mobility are a lot lower than the experts thought a couple of decades ago. to what extent this means that mobility has actually declined as opposed to that, you know, that people are looking more deeply at the evidence isn't completely clear, but you do see some things in our society now. The proliferation of dead-end jobs and the increasing importance of a four-year college degree, which itself is becoming increasingly easy to have if your parents were well-educated or if you were wealthy, this supports the proposition that maybe we are actually becoming a little less mobile.
Hmm. I see other trends also where, of course, there's always been inequality, and there's nothing wrong with some degree of inequality. We wouldn't want everybody's financial situation to be identical. But, for example, in 1980, the ratio between CEO pay at the big companies to average worker pay was 40 to 1. And that's higher than it is in most other industrialized countries, but it's still double digits. It's 42 to 1 in 1982. Now it's 301 to 1. So CEO pay has risen so much faster than worker pay in the decade since 1990. Average worker pay has gone up 49%, which sounds like a lot, except that inflation was 41%. So a little bit ahead of inflation over the 13 years. And CEO pay in the same time rose 313%. So, yes, I think this is an unprecedented level, or almost unprecedented level of inequality. I think in 1929 we were more unequal than we are today. And I think the other thing that's different is less and less do we have the government seeing its mission as lessening inequality, as providing the opportunities for everyone to have a fair start in life. And more we see the government thinking that its mission is to reward the campaign donors that put the politicians in office. And, you know, the theory is that somehow the money they give to investors in special tax breaks and loopholes and to big corporations is somehow supposed to trickle down to the rest of us. But I think this recent jobless recovery shows how much that theory doesn't work. Mm.
Well, let me I have a couple of callers I want to get to, and we'll do that in a moment. So if they won't mind waiting another minute or two, we'll get right to the calls. It is very clear if you take a look at how this has been graphed out that, say, in the 80s and the 90s, the gap between the poorest Americans and the wealthiest widened dramatically,
yes.
Very, very, very dramatic. And that if you look then at an earlier period, say just, you know, from around World War II up until 1979, mm-hmm. if you look there at, again, you graph out the break out the people by income by percentages, there you don't, it's more flat. You don't see this huge difference between the people at the top and the people at the bottom. So then the question comes, well, what happened in the 1980s and 90s to drive this big chasm that opened up between the wealthiest people and the poorest people?
I think that you look first at what didn't happen. There was a tremendous investment in public investment in things like the interstate highway system and the GI Bill that helped people rise up the income ladder, up the economic ladder in that post-war era that you speak of. And there has not been the same push for that kind of public investment in more recent years. And then I think that you have to really look at what's been... You have to analyze the vocabulary. This stuff is the politics that has been in charge the last 25 years has been the politics of deregulation, and a lot of what's called deregulation, if you look more closely at it, really is sort of rewriting the regulations to serve the interests of the wealthy and of the largest corporations. This is most dramatically apparent in what's been done with taxes, where the whole tax burden, what people call tax cuts, has really been a huge tax shift away from taxing wealth, away from taxing investment or any kind of financial machinations or wheeling and dealing, and toward taxing work. And obviously, the Bush tax cuts have had people have are pretty aware have been tilted towards the very wealthy, but this is really a kind of 30-year trend. There were things happening in the Clinton years, too, that tilted the same way.
Can I just interject there for one second, Jim, excuse me, but the more documentation of the tax shift that Jim's talking about, United for a Fair Economy did a report called Shifty Tax Cuts about who the burden's been shifted off of and onto, and the full report is on our website, which is faireconomy.org, www.faireconomy.org. You can download a PDF of the Shifty Tax Cuts report.
Okay. I'd just like to add, there are a million little examples of what's been done. And I don't mean to suggest that this entire trend has been the result of public policy or government policy by any means, but if you look at something like the CEO pay, companies were allowed to pay top executives in stock options and not to count this form of pay as an expense. And which made it tremendously easy to give huge rewards to top executives that didn't show up on the balance sheet that the shareholders were not aware of until kind of after the fact, until they saw how much their own holdings had been depleted. And in the 90s, the then head of the Securities and Exchange Commission, Arthur Levitt, fought to force companies to declare this form of compensation, but the corporate America, led by the tech companies, fought back, and Democrats as well as Republicans sided with them, and as a result, this little accounting fluke remained in law or in the accounting regulations, and we got one case after another of top executives who manipulated the stock price of their companies in order to walk off with huge windfalls, often while their companies weren't doing anything good for the country or the economy. I think this is just a microcosm of a lot of other things that have happened in the last 25 years.
We have some callers. I'd like to bring them into the conversation and also introduce again our guests. James Lardner, director and founder of inequality.org, and also Betsy Leander-Wright. She's communications director for the group United for a Fair Economy. And we're talking about income inequality in the United States. And questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. First caller up is in Savoy. That's line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes. I'd like to know if anyone knows how much of this inequality is due to want versus necessity.
Due to what versus what?
Want versus necessity. It's my impression that your typical American who's in a lot of debt is in a lot of debt because they purchased things or made decisions based on want, not necessity.
There certainly are people who get become bankrupt from foolish choices, but there was a study done of health care bills. And they found that something in the 40% of people who go through personal bankruptcy proceedings, that how they got into so much debt was catastrophic health care needs, illnesses and disabilities for which there was no health insurance. So I think that's the single biggest factor that is I would call health care a necessity. And I think there's often a precipitating family event, such as a divorce, a death, an illness, a layoff preceding personal bankruptcy. So while some of it, obviously, it's become much easier to get credit card debt, they're marketing debt to students and low-income people and people that there really is not a track record that they're going to be able to pay. That certainly has something to do with it, the pushing of credit card debt. But I think the single biggest thing is that with more and more jobs in this economy, you literally cannot make ends meet, that the cost of housing is so high and the wages are so low that the gap never closes. As you can see in Barbara Ehrenreich's book, Nickeled and Dimed, there are people that what they're getting paid it's just not going to cover the cost of living.
Does that get at your question?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
All right. Let's go to line number two, and this is someone in Champaign. Hello.
Yes. David kind of alluded to this in the beginning. Are you seeing, I don't know if you study things like ideology or political language, but are you finding a religious justification for an ideology for class inequality is being promoted or has been promoted in the last 20 years?
Yeah, I think there's something very interesting in Thomas Frank's book. I just finished reading the What's the Matter with Kansas, where he looks at why are people voting not in their financial self-interest, although especially white working class men voting for Republican politicians who then basically put into place or vote for policies that hurt those very same voters. He cites a redefinition of morality by some religious leaders as well as media pundits and so forth, where morality is all in the personal realm. Morality's in the bedroom, morality's in the media, swear words on TV, etc. And they're denying that there's any morality in the economic realm. And I think this is a really it's a very slippery thing that's done. And there's groups like Sojourners, Jim Wallis, the Call to Renewal. There are people in every major religion, but he's a Christian, an evangelical Christian, saying that no, actually, economic decisions are religious decisions. They are moral decisions. They have implications for how we treat our fellow humans. So I think there has been a redefinition of taking the economic out of the moral and religious realm, and then there's religious people fighting back against that.
And then, well, maybe in response or in the same line as the previous caller, maybe not in the same line, but along that point, I just got my bill for my car insurance, and it says that I can check with some credit agency to look and see if they might have charged me too much. They're implying that I could get less on my car insurance, a lower billing, if I had more retail accounts and I had gotten myself into more credit debt in the last 12 months, if I had total balances were greater and the number of accounts reported were greater, and that there was a lack of information reported on oil company accounts, so I guess I pay in cash or I use my Visa card. I mean, I do have a couple of credit cards, and I don't use them unless I can pay them off, but apparently this means that I have to pay more for my car insurance, because the implication is if you don't have a lot of debt running, then you're not going to take care of your car, or you're not a responsible person. So I just wanted to add that. I don't know if you have any comment on it or anything.
I think that story speaks for itself.
Right. Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Let's go to Champaign County, and next, line number three. Hello.
Hello. Yes. Sorry for the delay. I appreciate your emphasis on wealth and, you know, the assets versus liabilities, because I don't think that this gets discussed as much, and I think there's an important factoid in the way minorities in this country, some of whom are supposedly going up the economic ladder, how they fare in the aggregate. That would be good to hear you discuss on. But getting back to the idea of income, I heard Cheney on the stump say that they have a record of disposable income going up. Now, this goes contrary to what I've heard, which is that overall compensation may have gone up, but medical costs that have to come out of that typically are eating up any kind of gain, so the actual wages have gone down. The only thing I can think of to make him not the liar on this subject that he might be on others is that this category called disposable income might include what's called unearned income, you know, dividends from Microsoft et al., other kind of earnings. Now, is that an outright lie, or is it just a figure that, because it includes the some of those categories there, could actually be technically accurate but not actually describe what's going on in the country? And maybe that would allow you to generally talk about the super wealthy and how much of that other sort of category of unearned income, as it's called, which the call for that was to be not taxed at all not so long ago, which is a pretty amazing extension of the whole direction that things have gone.
The very phrase that you just used, unearned income, has almost passed out of the vocabulary. There there was, not only did the tax code treat it as something to be taxed more highly several decades ago, but there was an assumption behind that that we didn't want in America particularly to have a class of coupon clippers and rentiers and that somehow this kind of a life was not as meaningful did not contribute as much to our economy. Anyway, that's vanished entirely, and you get, as you say, the total opposite. This question about disposable income, I'm sorry to say, I don't have any numbers on. I can't quarrel or agree with Vice President Cheney. The first, maybe you do, Betsy, but the first issue that the caller raised about wealth and race, I know is an area you know something about.
Yeah, I'm glad you raised that question, because within the overall wealth divide, there's a racial wealth divide that has persisted through every era of our country. The times when the wealth gap shrank and when it grew, the racial wealth divide has loomed large. The most recent numbers we have from 2001, the people of color, the typical family, has $17,000 in net worth, which is a scary number. It's so low. The typical white family has $120,000. And by typical, I mean the median, the family in the middle. $120,000, most of it is in a primary home, the home people live in, so it doesn't necessarily mean that people have that much cash. But there is a security that comes from wealth that gives a stability to a family, gives you an ability to look forward into the future, pass something on to the next generation, that even middle-class people of color tend not to have. There's starting to be a black middle class, a Latino middle class, which is really great. There's always been a small one, but there's starting to be a bigger one. So there are people who have reasonable incomes, livable incomes. But there's a really great new book, Tom Shapiro's book, The Hidden Costs of Being African American, where he actually compares. He interviews families with the same income. So there'll be a black family and a white family that are both have family incomes of $50,000, say. And he asks them about their family history, their parents, and he finds that there's a huge difference in assets and in what's transmitted from the older generation. More of the black families are actually supporting people in the older generation, and far fewer of them are getting any inheritance. And most of the white families he talked to, he didn't talk to rich people, but there was a little boost from a family, whether it's a help with a down payment on a house or help with college tuition, and that he calls those transformative assets. They're the little family boost that give you, a start in life, because you can turn those into more assets later in life. We're writing a book at United for a Fair Economy about the racial wealth divide, and we're looking at the roots of this gap and finding it's government policies in the previous generations that are responsible for the bulk of the racial wealth divide, that the GI Bill boosted white GIs but not GIs of color. Social Security almost entirely helped white people for its first generation to two generations. So that kind of help from the government and help from previous generations is how people get ahead.
If I might follow up, on the subject of, you said people of color, which aggregates everybody together, and I've heard at least one analysis, I think it was from Manning Marable's book, that African Americans have a net liability to pass on to the next generation, as opposed to 17,000 or whatever. Does that sound...
He might be referring to financial wealth only, setting aside home ownership. About 46% of African Americans own their home, which is far less than the 76% of white Americans, but it still is almost 50%. So the median does have some assets, but earlier, the Federal Reserve is the one who does the study on wealth, and I think there was a zero number for financial wealth, meaning money and stocks and bonds, in one of the surveys a few years ago.
Do you have anything to add about the disposable income idea? What does that involve? Is that Is that different from wages and compensation and or wages only because of the so-called unearned income?
I think that income puts together wages and salaries, income from assets, as you said, and also government transfers like Social Security and welfare. And I think one of the reasons that we see the surge in income at the top is because the people who get their income primarily from assets have grown. And, of course, wages have stagnated for the last 25 years, and government transfers have actually gone down. So since 1979, the bottom 20% only has increased above inflation 3%. Whereas the top 5% has gone up 81%. So I think you're onto something about about the different types of income and why we see the disparities that we do.
Well, thank you.
All right, thanks. We're a little bit past the midpoint here, and I should introduce again our guests for this part of Focus 580. Betsy Leon de Wright is Communications Director for the organization United for a Fair Economy, and Jim Lardner is the founder of the website inequality.org. In both cases, both organizations that are interested in promoting greater awareness of discussion of the issue of wealth inequality in the United States. And, of course, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Just, we'll get on some other callers in a moment, but I want to give you both the opportunity to talk a little bit about what you think could be done to address the issue, assuming that we think that this gulf is not a healthy thing for the country. Particularly a little bit earlier, Mr. Lardner was talking about the things that the government had done in previous generations to foster economic well-being, things like investing in the highway system, the GI Bill. I would assume also you would think about government investment in education, for example, in public education, probably a number of things like that. And then also some of the things that have happened in the more recent decades, including changes in tax policy, for example. If we said here today, now, we wanted to do something what we could do to try to close the gap between the wealthiest Americans and the poorest Americans, what would you suggest we could do?
Well, in the first place, it's a sad fact, but I think one we ought to recognize, that a lot of the things we might think of doing are way, way off the table. I think it took some courage, actually, in the current environment where any talk of raising taxes on anybody is politically dangerous. It took some courage for the Democratic candidate for president and vice president both to say that they would repeal the top end of the Bush tax cuts if they were elected. They've talked about some other things in terms of expanded public investment in health care and education. But it is a fairly modest agenda because of the state of our politics, which has been we've had 30 years of a very effective thought, I don't want to say thought control, thought influencing by a very well-funded right-wing ideology machine, so that, you know, taxes are bad and government regulation is you talk about the slightest little regulation and the right makes it sound like you're talking about, you know, this return to the Soviet Union and, you know, central control of the economy. So a lot of what needs to be done for starters is to kind of open up the discourse and begin to talk about these questions. And I think that the political process is a good place to begin here as well. We have a society now in which, you know, corporations, you pass the McCain-Feingold Act and then a couple of years pass and it's not clear what's exactly been accomplished, because when you have such incredible concentrations of money in a few hands, corporate and individual, they're going to find a way, you know, to to that money power is going to find a way to assert itself over the political process. It's going to find a way to assert itself over the healthcare system. Almost no matter what you do in each one of these zones. Anyway, to return to your subject, to your specific question, the only thing I would add, aside from changes in the tax law, and is a hard look at the commons, at both natural assets and socially created assets like the internet, intellectual property, the airwaves that have been kind of given away to large corporate interests in recent years, creating, by the way, less competition and more near monopoly situations, as well as more inequality. There's a big conversation that America needs to have that has been suppressed for some time on this whole subject.
Betsy, you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, I would second everything that Jim said, and I think that there are some things that, as you said, are off the table, but there are some things that a huge percentage of Americans agree on, such as that no one who works full-time should be poor, which involves raising the minimum wage and not subsidizing corporations that pay substandard wages, trying to control the job loss overseas. These issues poll remarkably high. Better public education, more help with health care costs. And the problem is that the voters are divided on social issues, and it serves the people currently in power and the right-wing media operation to keep the focus on the social issues where we disagree with each other. I've written about this on a website that's classmatters.org, www.classmatters.org, because I think we're letting ourselves get divided by class and race as well as by our political opinions. You know, we're not going to agree anytime soon on abortion or on guns or on the role of religion in public life. And yet we do agree that this should be a fairer economy. It should not be that it's so cushy at the top, that there's people being handed things, people being rewarded for corporate malfeasance and being handed things without working for them, when other people are working so hard, working two and three jobs and not being able to make ends meet. We do agree on that, and I think we need to hold our politicians accountable that whatever we want them to do on other issues, we need some responsiveness on this. We need them to take these economic concerns seriously, and we need to speak as one with one voice as the American people. And I think that's how we're going to get some action out of our government.
I'd like to add one small thing to what Betsy said, which is I think there's a lot of agreement, too, about the influence of large corporations, of the sort of mega corporations that have grown to such a point that it's even hard to say what their purpose is, what their product line is, where they're based. I think a lot of Americans some of whom would identify themselves as liberal or left or middle, and others middle of the road, and others conservative or right, probably share some deep apprehension about what corporations are doing to the texture of life in this country, and it's not on the table, precisely because the leaders of our main political institutions have insisted that we argue endlessly about gay marriage.
I think Walmart is the most perfect example that you can see. In one corporation now, the biggest private employer in the United States, I think they've single-handedly changed the economic landscape. Here we have five of the 10 richest people in the world are Sam Walton's heirs, with $20 billion or more each. How did they get that money? Well, Walmart pays substandard wages. They average, including everybody, including the management, $9 an hour. They've been caught violating child labor laws, making people pay when making people work when they're off the timesheet. The biggest class action suit by women in the history has just been certified that it is okay to go forward, that they were underpaying their women employees. They give no the health benefits. People have to put in so much for the health that the majority of them can't afford it. And yet, they've had all these public subsidies. There's a great study by Good Jobs First. They found more than $1 billion in government subsidies, taxpayer money, going to entice Walmart stores to come to various places around the country. And so many people who work for Walmart are eligible for welfare programs that the average store has $420,000 in government subsidies going to the employees who are eligible for things like food stamps and Medicaid. So our tax dollars are going to help a corporation lower wages overall, cause jobs to go overseas, so that some people can become so massively and obscenely rich that you couldn't spend it in 10 lifetimes. There shouldn't be individuals with $20 billion. I think that one story sums it all up.
Well, we have a number of callers. Let's see what's on their minds. We'll take them in the order they came in. That means we'll start with Urbana and line two right here. Hello.
Yeah, I was looking at a graph out of a article called Income Inequality in the United States, 1913 through 1998, which parallels what Mr. Inge was talking about. There are two things that were kind of interesting. One was that back in 1913, the share of income by the very top 0.1% was a heck of a lot more than it is today even. And, you know, in Great Britain, it was almost 12%. In the United States, it was almost 9%. And then as David said, it's been drifting down and down and down until about the 50s. And it's kind of interesting that we had the First World War, the Second World War, the rise of communism. I don't know if they were really related or not, but I think it's the other interesting thing is in this chart, now that it's started going up again, we're the ones that are really leading the way. And it only covers United Kingdom, France, and the United States, but we're the ones that are spiking up with the an increasing share of income to that 0.1%. And Britain is trying to follow us, but oddly enough, France isn't, you know. And maybe that's why there was so much animosity, or part of the reason why there was so much animosity to France. I don't know. But I just wanted to ask you, what's happening in other countries out there? From what I gather from this article, it appears that it's really the United States and the United Kingdom that's trying to, you know, or is on a track for increasing inequality, and that I'm guessing that a lot of the rest of the world is not. Would you know very much about the international situation? I'll hang up and listen to
that. Okay. I know that there is some of that kind of information on, I've seen it on inequality.org.
Yes. Of the developed nations, the United States in income inequality, most people agree, ranks at the bottom. That is to say, you know, Sweden and Finland and Belgium and Norway and Denmark, Austria, the Netherlands, Germany, France. I've just read off to you the list in order of, the most equal toward the most unequal. This is measured according to the ratio of what people at the near the top, at the 90th percentile, how much they make to those near the bottom, down at the 10 percentile mark, make. And so, for example, in Sweden, the ratio is 2.59. That's a pretty egalitarian society, whereas in the United States, it's, you know, 5.64. And we also seem to be out in front in terms of the share of wealth owned by the wealthiest 20%. These numbers aren't so recent, but the wealthiest 20% owned, you know, close to 80% in this country, whereas it's, you know, in Canada, it's 68% or something. I mean, this is the United States has As the caller suggested, whatever's happened in absolute terms, what has happened in relative terms is that the United States, which was a comparatively egalitarian society, 75, 50 years ago, compared to what we used to call the class-ridden old world, is now at the other end of the spectrum.
All right. Well, I hope that gets at the question of the caller. Let's continue. We'll go next to a caller in Spring Bay. That's on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Yes, good morning. Mm-hmm. That comment from Dick Cheney about the amount of disposable income, I got to thinking, well, really the important figure would seem to me the number of people or the number of families who would have disposable income. I think that would be a much more interesting number to know. And I'd like to hear what your guests have to say about that. In other words, there might be more money, but again, it's being controlled by fewer people or something like that.
Well, I'm not sure. I hadn't heard this number from Dick Cheney. I'm not sure what new income numbers he's referring to. Mostly their annual numbers from the census is what we use as the reliable figures on income. So the most recent that we have is 2003. I think that the caller is pointing out the difference between an average and a median, that when you take average numbers, then things tend to look fairly rosy because, like, if you say the average between me and Bill Gates is, you know, we've each got $30 billion, I'm doing pretty well, you know, but the median is the family in the middle. The median income is the one that's been stagnating in recent years. And there may have been a little surge of income right now because we're out of a recession. There was such high unemployment there for a while, and so many people were running out of their unemployment benefits. Unemployment finally has taken a small dip to more accessible numbers, primarily for white workers. Unemployment for African Americans is still over 10% of the official unemployment, and of course unofficially is higher than that because so many people are out of the labor force. But for white Americans, I think we have a little welcome relief from the high unemployment that we had earlier in this decade.
One limitation of discussions of this subject as they're carried on usually is that they focus totally on material things and don't get to what's happening to our democracy, what's happening to our sense of community when people no longer have a shared sense of experience. They no longer are inclined to participate in the same kinds of inclusive community organizations and volunteer organizations that were one of America's great strengths in the past. But even if you just look at the material dimension, I'm afraid it's beginning to be that instead of being the world's richest country, as we often have described ourselves, we are becoming the country with the world's richest rich people, which is a little bit different.
Yeah. Could I ask a follow-up, David?
Sure.
Along with what you were just saying there, in the 50s and 60s when I was growing up, most families made it on one income. Then women wanted to go into the workforce in the 60s, but now it seems like it is a necessity. It's no longer an option for two incomes. It's a necessity. And could you comment on, has our standard of living markedly decreased in this country in the last 50 years? And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right.
Well, the one thing I'd like to say on that subject is that if you compare the United States with other developed nations, we do put in more working hours, and those in the middle of the income spectrum who have managed either to get ahead or to stay even have done so typically with more combined hours of work, and this means that there is less time for children, for one thing, and less time for community, for another thing. I don't want to paint some glowing portrait of the 1950s, which obviously had big problems, but these are areas in which I think inequality is exacting a toll that is not easily measured.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think that especially with welfare reform, we have delegitimized staying home and caring for children, elderly people, people with disabilities. We've made it harder to do it because you can't get if you're low income, you can't get the government to help you do it. And you know, I was part of the feminist revolution of the 70s, and the idea was not that no one would ever stay home with kids ever again. The idea is it shouldn't be mandatory, which of course was a very good goal, that people shouldn't be stuck in that role just because of their gender. But I think there's a crisis of how do we as a society support caretaking? People need care, kids need care, people with severe disabilities, elderly people, and you know, we're paying for less of it with our tax dollars, with the various cutbacks of human services, and we're making it harder, both because of needing two incomes, making it harder for family members to do it, and because of welfare reform. There's a wonderful book whose name escapes me by Nancy Fulbright about this, that the value on caring and the societal resources devoted to caring have been cut back, and there's been an ideology that that's not a legitimate thing to do. And, you know, people need care. We have to deal with this one way or another as a society. Right now, a lot of very, very tired people are racing around, earning money to pay for child care and elder care and caring for their own kids and being paid to pay for other people's kids. We're exhausting ourselves.
We have exhausted our time, so we're going to have to stop there. And I'm sorry to have to interrupt you, Betsy, but we're
no
just
problem.
Going to have to stop. We have with us Betsy Leander Wright, Communications Director for United for a Fair Economy, Jim Lardner from inequality.org. Thank you both very much for talking with us today.
Oh, my pleasure, David.
Bye. Thank you.